This podcast is brought to you in partnership with the Music Venue Trust. The Music Venue Trust is a UK registered charity which acts to protect, secure and improve grassroots music venues. The Music Venue Trust works to gain recognition of the essential role these venues fulfil, not only for artist development, but also for the cultural and music industries, the economy and local communities. They aim to preserve and improve venues, making them more efficient and improving the experience of performers and audiences. During the COVID crisis, Music Venue Trust mobilised music lovers to support the Save Our Venues campaign, raising over £5 million to support grassroots music venues and prevent closures. They worked hard to try and ensure that venues would survive and be ready to reopen when public health guidelines permitted. Now that some venues are able to reopen, Music Venue Trust is working to revive live, but that does not mean that all venues are financially secure. The next few months will continue to be challenging for everyone, and they will continue to fundraise for the venue support services Music Venue Trust offers, especially for those venues in need of the GMV crisis service. There are some exciting Save Our Venues projects still being worked on, so please do support where you can. Visit www.saveourvenues.co.uk to donate and do your part. Another episode of We Didn't Know How Good We Had It, and this week I'm really pleased to be joined by Gareth from USA Nails. How are you doing, Gareth?
Hey, yeah, I'm good. Thank you for having me.
No, thank you for joining me. It's a pleasure to have you. I've been a big fan of you guys for quite some time, and it was a pleasure to drop you an Instagram message, slide into those DMs, I think the kids say, and actually get a response as well. So thank you so much for that, and for sharing the podcast with Andy, who's a huge fan of you guys as well. We were just talking about him beforehand. How have you been? How's the sort of the last, let's say, 18 months sort of been, if you can put a pin in it, like?
It's been different. I mean, it's been a time of trying to find things to keep myself busy. I mean, mm-hmm. The bands, USA Nails, haven't been too busy, obviously, with the sort of ongoing lockdowns. I mean, we did release an album at the back end of last year, but that was something that we'd recorded long before COVID kicked off. So yeah, it was good that we had that to work on and to make videos for and sort out all, you know, the boring sort of...
All the admin sides of being in a band, I guess.
Exactly, yeah. So we had plenty of time. And for a change, actually, we were all massively on top of that. You know, everything, we met all our self-imposed, admittedly, deadlines and got all our videos done and everything. So yeah, in that respect, it was quite successful. But in other respects, I mean, obviously, lots of cancelled shows, in particular, a US tour that we were meant to go on in April. So it was literally, you know, if that tour had been booked...
Almost, yeah,
if it had been booked like 2 months earlier, we would have been able to do it, but... It was literally coming up to like a few weeks of sort of March, and it's like, oh, what's going on? And then, yeah, obviously, well, we know what happened.
Well, everything happened, I feel. Have you been sort of, are you pretty creative at home, or is it more of a, you know, life at home, and then when you go to maybe your lockup or your studio with the band and stuff, and that's when all the creative juices sort of come out? Have you had time at home to sit and write or anything like that?
Yeah, I have done more than I normally would have. To be honest, USA Nails don't really, we very rarely go to rehearsals with material prepared. We kind of write in the room. That was kind of the one of the things that defines the band, that it's all quite spontaneous and it's quite fast. So there's not much forethought in it. It's all just
and see what happens.
Pretty much, yeah. But obviously, with not being able to do that, you know, we've been more writing at home. We recorded a couple of sort of charity EPs, like of covers,
yeah.
Which we each did a few each and just used drum machines and just did them at home on our home setups, and, you know, just as something to tide us over. So yeah, we've been doing stuff, and I've been trying to get into my video editing a bit more. I've been asked to do a few things, and so is Tom, actually. Tom is really, our drummer, is doing some amazing work at the moment, video wise, and he's sort of going full time with that now, I think. But he did an amazing video for John recently, which is absolutely incredible. I mean, both his technical and his conceptual abilities are like grown exponentially. I'm so happy for him. He's doing some amazing work.
It's great to know, like, obviously, you're probably the same, where you'll be chatting with, like, your musical peers or you know, people at labels, etc., and seeing how the last year has affected them one way or another. And I've noticed a real positive thing from the creative arts people, where they feel like they've had a lot of free time that they would not necessarily have been able to have in the first place, which, you know, with touring, with normal everyday life, with work, it's sort of almost like a pause button where you can, like, having... what's the name of that 50 pence piece when we were kids watching it on the telly? I completely forgot. The Queen's Nose. You rub that and then everything pauses for 12 months and you get a bit more freedom to do it. I know a lot of people felt a lot of creative people felt a lot of pressure to produce music, to produce art of some description. But I think the further into the 12 months, sort of starting from last March time, like you mentioned, I think that sort of eased off a lot of people and it gave them, rather than pressure to create stuff, the freedom to create more stuff as well. And it's great to hear, obviously, with Tom's been able to do more, you know, let that idea sort of flow into even more like a professional side to it as well, like from a hobby to a full-time thing. That's really great to hear. Did you feel any real pressure or anything to write stuff? I know that might not necessarily be your guys' style, is to be like, we've got to get an album out this year, we've got to do this, we've got to do that. It's like quite free-flowing, like you said. But did you feel like, oh, we're musicians now, we've got time, people might be expecting stuff from us?
No.
That's good. No,
it is the sort of long and short answer. I think our last album was our fifth, and we've averaged an album every 18 months, which is much faster than any other band I've ever worked in before. And to be honest, like, five albums is a lot for any band. So if we are, you know, to have to take our foot off the gas isn't, you know, it's not the end of the world for us. I think
did it feel slightly better knowing that you had it in the bag, I guess, where, you know, all the hard work, the touring is, in my eyes, is the hard work, because those are the things where you're getting 3 hours sleep, sleeping on people's floors and all that sort of side to it. But was it nice having that in the bag, knowing that, right, if this year doesn't happen, we've still got a record to release. We've still got people that will be excited for it and still be waiting for us to go on tour or play individual shows once everything starts to open up again.
Yeah, no, it was good. We were fortunate in that respect. So yeah, it was, and as I said before, it was nice to be able to, not nice, but it was convenient to be able to focus on all the admin side of things. So yeah, and yeah, I suppose it did take the pressure on. Maybe that's why we didn't feel like we'd, you know, if that recording session had been a few months later and we would have had to cancel it, then we still wouldn't have maybe even recorded a bit by this point. Yeah, who knows what would have happened. But I guess the sort of, things sort of actually worked out in terms of the album recording and release and stuff.
How have you found the reception to the album? I mean, I was listening to it again in my kitchen earlier on and I love it. It's like... I was trying to put it into a couple of words, and I think, if you don't mind me saying, they're kind of like, they're pop songs masquerading as like noise punk songs. So many really good hooks. If you listen sort of, you're sort of below the surface of it, there's lots of really good hooks, and some of Steve's lyrics are like really, really catchy and poignant and stick with you throughout the album. But yeah, how have you found the reception sort of, maybe, like I say, critically, you know, from maybe some of your musical peers or just from people commenting on it like online?
On the whole, pretty good. We did well with getting some. We got more radio play with this. Not that a band of our stature really gets that much radio play at all, but yeah, to get a few things and like we got a few plays on Radio One, which is really weird. And even so, we got played on the indie show, and I mean, you know, I'm too old for Radio One. I hadn't listened to it in ages, and they wanted to do an interview. So they ended an interview with Steve, and our radio guy was like, "Well, yeah. So Jack has quite a kinetic sort of style on the radio. He really likes it. His guests will reciprocate that." And Steve was like, "I'm almost 40 and I'm bald. Does he know that?" But to be fair, Steve was all right. But it is like, I don't know. my parents' generation when MTV came around and it just all like flashing lights and stuff. It's kind of the equivalent of that. But that's like, yeah. So that went well in that respect. We pressed more copies of the record this time as well. We've got a label in the US and one in the Europe, and did bigger runs, and they seem to have sold well. Would have sold better if we've been able to tour it, obviously. But
yeah, well, that's it. Like, do you feel like I mentioned it earlier, and I've mentioned this to a few of the guests as well, that when you have a record to come out, let's take like the guys from Haggard Cat released something back in March last year, and they were due to tour it from April, and they basically just put everything on pause. The record came out, but then obviously the shows are going to have to be postponed by a year at least. But you've got people who are really excited to go and see that record played live, regardless of what act it is. Do you have the tour plans been postponed or anything like that, or are you just looking to see sort of what happens? I know the America one might be hard to comment on, because who knows what's happening over there at any given time, to be completely honest with you. But what about any UK shows and festivals and things? What's in the pipeline?
So we've got like three things planned for the autumn, just three UK shows. Mm-hmm. Touring plans, we're sort of holding on. I mean, we book all our own tours, so having to book and then reschedule is just so knackering. We all work full time. So we're waiting until until there's a little bit more certainty before we sort of think about trying to book anything more substantial. And I hope we will try and go to the States again, but who knows what will happen. I mean, it was it's just like a case of waiting.
Put you on the spot on here, this one. So.
No, not at all. It is like you say. I mean, like a lot of bands, it's just you don't really know and like what you're gonna do.
Do you find yourself in a good position where you are in control of, like I said, of touring yourselves? You're able to plan that. You're not necessarily having an agent behind you saying, right, we have to reschedule this for these dates. Is it nice knowing that, let's say stuff got pulled last year, which is really unfortunate, but then you can go, right, we can actually go back to these cities when is feasible and sensible for you guys, but also everyone else involved. It's, I guess you're not, playing to the man, I guess, and saying, we have to do 20 dates. 20 dates have to be postponed exactly every date, one after the other. So now you're playing in Manchester on a Monday and whatever. Is it nice having that little bit of freedom behind it?
We've worked with bookers for stretches before and in previous bands kind of. And as much as it's booking a tour is like so knackering.
Yeah.
Especially as you're a band doing, if you're a booking agent, it's the thing you do day in, day out, and you've got all the contacts and you know the routes and you know your backline people and all blah blah blah. Mm-hmm. Then it's when it's your bread and butter. But I book a couple of tours a year maximum, and it's hard work and getting everything to line up and then keeping
tour logistics is something I feel like the everyday person, the music consumer, doesn't quite get behind. When you see when a band like yourself to release a tour, and let's say you just haven't got Bristol on the list, for example, and then you'll have so many people going, why aren't you playing in Bristol? And we're like, you're playing in Norfolk the day before and we're playing in Glasgow the day after, and it doesn't make sense. I don't think people quite appreciate that. You're still like four or five dudes in a van trying to make the most out of the British motorway system, I guess, and trying to tie it all together properly.
And trying to do as much as we can in a half term.
Because people don't realize musicians have kids and jobs and lives outside of playing their guitar and everything as well. So I would say that one of my favorite shows is good few years back with you guys is supporting Future of the Left down here in Cardiff at Club. I'm a really big Future of the Left fan, as I guess you guys are. Same. As well.
And kind
of Falco is quite the fan of you guys too. But I just remember, I don't think I'd seen you guys before, or if I had, it might have been like a couple of festivals, and standing at the front, because I like to get stuck in, even though the size of me says I probably shouldn't get stuck in, but I like getting stuck in at Future of the Left gigs, and Steve just stared at me the entire time. And like you said, I think he must have gone, picking on that lad there. And I honestly, it was the most memorable thing. Like it was, I felt so engaged in the whole thing about the show because I had this big 6 foot, whatever tall, bald guy just piercing his eyes straight through me. It was fantastic, to be completely honest with you.
I was going to apologize.
No, honestly, like it was one of the most intense moments of my adult life, and it was with another man, so I kind of enjoyed it a lot. I don't know.
Is that something that Steve does at every show? I'm not sure. But
if it's not, I feel really, really privileged. So
yeah. I mean, I think that was that the show. Frauds played as
yeah.
well. Was
yeah,
that,
that's
that
right.
One?
Yeah. I think Frauds opened, and then it was you mm-hmm. guys, and then Future of the Left. Cause I think Future of the Left did two dates, one after the other, and they had Saint Pierre Snake Invasion with them.
Right.
The day yeah. after. Stupidly went to both shows, having gone to work the whole time, but you've got to do what you've got to do, eh?
Yeah, well, it sounds pretty cool. I mean, I lived in Cardiff for a few years as a student, and I really like that venue.
I feel the community based around that venue, if, like I said, you experienced it before, is so strong now as well as it would have been a few years back. That it sort of ties everywhere together. Like if you've been in a touring band, whether you play in front of 10 people or the 300 people you can get upstairs in club, like it's the same community of people going to each show, whether it's a heavy metal band or an indie band. And it's really, really nice to see. So I'm glad you've experienced club outside of just playing a show there, because most bands' experience of upstairs in club is an absolute nightmare loading in. And I every time I go to book a show there, I message Adam or Will and say, is downstairs available? Because I'm only 30, but my back can't handle helping a van load in upstairs anymore.
Yeah, that fire escape is knackering.
I can't wait. They're supposed to be putting a lift in, but, you know, who knows what's happening.
Really? Yeah, wow.
So they're supposed to be expanding, going off on a tangent here, expanding sideways into the building next door and hopefully having a lift fitted so that it's more accessible, obviously, for anyone who may be in a wheelchair or having accessibility issues. But also every band in the whole UK touring circuit that hears that club upstairs will have a lift will be hopefully the first venue on the list of the tour.
It's lovely to hear about a venue, you know, flourishing and doing well enough to be able to expand like that as well. That's great.
It was a year or so ago, probably 18 months now, where the sort of plans were announced and what they'd like to do and whether the planning and stuff goes ahead. But I think the idea is still there, and we're all of us down in Cardiff are really excited. I will go down with bricks and mortar and help them do it myself if it means getting it done. But yeah, like I said, I'm glad that you've experienced club as a punter as well as having to carry you around up those stairs, because I don't mean that on any band ever, but yeah, great venue to play, terrible venue to load into. I was having a look online earlier on, just sort of just doing a bit of my research and saw an interview that you did where you were talking about the albums that sort of shaped you and stuff. And I spotted a Chemical Brothers album on there and things like that. Sort of going into the bands that we're going to talk about in a couple of minutes time. Are there any of these albums that tie in with that sort of the bands that shaped you as well as the bands that you miss? I know without giving too much away, you've got Mission of Burma on the list, which I guess are a band from, well, I suppose the late 70s, getting back, you know, Spain up, getting back together and stuff. Are any of those records the albums that shaped you, as the, I think the headline was?
So the ones from that article before?
So like I guess different style of questioning they had on that one, but are any of these bands that are on the list that you've given me sort of albums that you go, right, that sort of guided me a bit here or give me a bit of a sort of musical boost?
I mean, yeah, all of them to a greater or lesser extent. I mean, any sort of great band, I don't know, for me, any great band is a band that sort of, you know, elicits or evokes a reaction from you. And that could be like, I don't know, an emotional reaction or inspires you.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and yeah, I don't know. That's for me, that's what, I don't know, when I see a band or when I hear a band and they make me want to do what I do better or approach what I approach better, that's kind of make me want to be a better musician, a better person. So
a lot of the bands that people tend to bring up on this podcast are bands that let's say they're friends bands from, you know, to the mid-2000s, for example, and the reason that you're just so engraved in them is because you watched them start from, you know, college, for example, and go on to there. Mm-hmm. So that band might not mean a lot to a lot of people, but it means a lot to them. And, you know, are any of these acts sort of like that? Were they sort of around the same sort of scenes and things? Because I guess, just looking at this again, I don't want to give them away. I'm going to let you sort of go off of them. But are they more, you toured with them, you played with them, you watched them sort of grow?
So a couple of them in particular, Nikovsky, who incidentally Andy talked about when you had him from Andy Birthday Cake, and Shield Your Eyes were bands that were sort of peers, I suppose, and toured with them, saw them a lot, hung out with them, and they were sort of good friends and inspiring people to boot as well. Yeah.
Good. So that's why I like to hear where you've got bands that are your friends, but you like them because their music's great, not just because you sort of feel an obligation to like them because they're your mates, which sometimes doesn't always work. But let's get into a couple of them. Where would you like to start? I'll let you sort of pick of the draw.
Well, might as well start talking about Nikovsky start with. It was from listening to your conversation with Andy before talking about them sort of made me sort of quite reminiscent of them. And I remember that show because you talked with him about their gig at ArcTangent, which turned out to be their last gig ever. But they're such an uncompromising band and such a almost to the point of, they were, it almost felt like they were making things harder for themselves than they wanted to. They would never, they were so single-minded about how they wanted to approach things, and they didn't really, they're kind of hard looking dudes.
I think that's how Andy said it. He goes, oh, they look like hard dudes. And then I bet you had a beautiful chat with them afterwards. And they, you know, never like what they are on stage, but.
And they are like, I feel like they never really, they had an appeal which worked with a kind of ArcTangent sort of crowd, but that wasn't really their background. And that wasn't what they were, in terms of their taste, that wasn't really what they were into. They came from a more sort of, I don't know, free jazz, experimental punk, techno sort of background. Yeah. They would get booked for sort of things with sort of big scary monsters bands and all that sort of thing. And they never really, that wasn't really there.
Yeah.
Although they could be sort of grouped with those bands in some respects, that wasn't really their sort of vibe in terms of their journey of how they arrived at their sound. So, but they never, I'm tying myself in knots here trying to.
I know what you mean. Like the way Andy described them was perfect. He was like, it was that wash of noise when you see them live, that sort of, I think it was Nick from Trojan Horse said, like, it cleansed him basically in the morning. And said, that's exactly what I needed. That was like my morning noise rock sorbet, or like mid-afternoon, I think he probably would have been by that time. But I know what you mean. Like, they're a very harsh band to listen to if it's not really, like, I wouldn't throw them in with big scary monsters bands, but also wouldn't throw them in with sort of some of the heavier bands or any alcopop bands, you know, that sort of pink misty vibe. Mm-hmm. They're almost like too much in every direction for any of those scenes, if you know what I mean. And I appreciate that, because I guess it means that they're not pigeonholing themselves, but it also might not necessarily be by design. It's that is just how that they are.
And I think the three, apart from Mike, the guy who was playing synths on the last album, so it was just the two guitarists and the drummer on the first two records. And but they'd moved to London together with a different band, partly to try and see if they could do some stuff with this band. But I think they were all kind of a bit unsatisfied with that band. And Nikovsky came out after that. The last band they had maybe tried to compromise with it, maybe artistically, logistically. And I guess Nikovsky was their way of, rallying against that and just doing things completely on their own terms. I mean, to be honest, if I asked them that, they'd probably just tell me to fuck off and being an idiot. But that's what it seemed like to me. And I know, in fact, I spoke to Mike the other day about this, and he was like, yeah, that ArcTangent show, they basically just left straight after, so they didn't even get... Because they went down really well at that show.
Yeah.
But they just left because Dan had to, like, do a techno night in London that night. And now Dan does, like, this amazing, like, noisy, visceral techno act called UKAEA. And it's mind-blowing. It's so good, but in a way that kind of feels he's more at home doing that now. And Ed, the other guitarist, is mainly does stuff with Sly and the Family Drone, who are, like, this noise collective.
Yeah.
And maybe them being in those, and I'm in a band with Mike now, actually doing another band, but they all feel like maybe they're more at home in those where they've ended up than, but at the same time, it was those pulling in those weird different directions, which is what made that band so interesting and so weird.
I think, I guess, you could look at the lineup for that ArcTangent festival that specific year, look at Nikowski, and then look at one band from every stage that has a bit of, you know, Nikowski have a bit of them in it, whether again, like, subconsciously or whatever. And that's why I suppose that scene, and I suppose our scene, would be drawn to them, to watching them. Just having, like, word of mouth going, there's a band playing on stage at 2:30 in the afternoon, everyone should go see them because they sound like every band that's also here. And by that we mean every band altogether, rather than just, you know, middle of the road. But the way Andy described them, I've set myself the worst job in the world by finding out about these bands after they split up. they'd be right up my street, especially as Nick said, from the ArcTangent show, that it cleansed you a bit. It was harsh enough to, like, wash over you and still be really, really interesting and complex and, you know, no holds barred, balls to the wall, sort of, this is what we want to do and we're going to do it.
Yeah, the last record in particular, I am biased because a label I sort of used to help run sort of co-released that last record of theirs as well. It's all sold out, so there's no ulterior motive.
There's no cronyism going on, don't worry.
They're all gone. But yeah, that last record, Effortless Charm, is like everything. So the first two records, they're great, but just everything came together with the last one, with the synth work on it, and the production is just everything just sounds great on it. It's such a good record, and maybe if there's any justice in the world in the future, it will become one of those sort of, you know, it'll be rediscovered in years to come, and
like a cult sort of thing, I guess.
And people wonder how it flew under the radar.
So it's a lot more experimental stuff is having that happen to it now, I guess. Like, this is going to sound really like I'm turning into my dad here, but a lot of people are really getting back into King Crimson and things like that now. Whereas when I was younger, and my dad would go, listen to this King Crimson album, and I'd go, absolutely not. Why would I want to listen to that? I'm going to sit and listen to the Red Hot Chili Peppers instead. But bands like that, I guess, are getting more in the math post, that sort of scene, bringing that back out to them. And maybe Nikowski will be, I'm not saying they're going to be King Crimson by any stretch. I feel like it's an unfair thing to put on them, but
they probably hate that, actually. So,
I was reading a review, I think it was from Feckin' Bahamas. And they said, like, a lot of it was tip of the cap to King Crimson, and they're, like, into what, like, twining guitar lines. And I mean, don't get me wrong, I couldn't hear any in it personally, but I didn't write the review, so they can shout to Feckin' Bahamas about that whenever that was written. But yeah, maybe it will be along those lines. Like you said, someone will find it in their CD collection or their record collection, and then play it to some mates at a house party, and they go, what is this, and where is this come from, and why haven't I got more of this in my life? And they go, too late, you know, you didn't know how good you had it.
With any luck, we'll see.
Let's move on from Nikowski again to anyone you like to bring up. So I know we mentioned Mission of Burma earlier on. I had James from Mutes. He was really, really passionate about this act, and again, it's another band that passed me by. If you want to go into anyone, let's say.
Mission of Burma, why not? I mean, they were a band that I'd heard about. Strangely, the first time I ever heard of them was when I was a teenager. I was really into Blur, and Graham Coxon released a few solo albums and still does. But the second one had like two Mission of Burma covers on it. And before that, I hadn't heard of them. And it was like, they were the two best songs on the record. And so after that, I was kind of hooked on this band. And I don't know, they're a band that stayed with me. You know, bands that you're into come and go, I suppose, don't they? But
yeah.
But I know both Steve and Dan in particular really sort of love Mission of Burma as well. And I mean, they are, you know, they're sort of a legendary DIY band, you know, and like quite an experimental, well, fairly experimental for their time.
I guess for the 80s or the very late 70s, the 80s, you absolutely hit nail on the head that would, because they stemmed lots of other bands. I say not necessarily with them, but they're thrown in the same sort of bat as like Sonic Youth and bands like that were experimenting.
Mm.
During the sort of the late 80s, mid to late 80s. When did you sort of first come across them? I mean, you said like you were a teenager in school, was it like on the Walkman or something?
Yeah, so I don't know. I remember. So I guess probably just reading about, I think I read the review of this Graham Coxon record and it's like two Mission of Burma songs. Mm-hmm. Who are they? but being sort of blown away by, hunting down the sort of actual thing and thinking, oh, this is a band I'll never, you know, just thinking it's just some old band. But they sort of went in and out of existence a few times.
Yeah.
And like, so they predate Sonic Youth really. But then at the same time, I guess they were sort of contemporary to them as well. I mean, Sonic Youth had a really long lifespan anyway. So
I think up until maybe 3 or 4 years ago, didn't they? Yeah.
Yeah. So, and I think I saw them, Mission of Burma, at like maybe an ATP festival.
Yeah.
That would have been the first time I saw them. And I guess one of the reasons that I added them to the list, because you mentioned stuff about bands that you toured with or played with, but we were lucky enough to actually be asked to support them in what might have been their second to last London show, which was, for us, was like, well, for me personally, is a huge high point in terms of our band and the opportunities that we have. I mean, I love so many of the bands we played with, but in terms of like a proper, you know, trailblazing and formative band for me, like it was unreal to be asked to play with them. Not by them personally.
You never know. They could have had a word.
Maybe I'll imagine that. I mean, we did sort of meet them and speak to them a bit afterwards, and most of them seemed quite friendly. So
they've been around for so long. I guess they've played so many shows and met so many people and stuff. And not that that's any excuse. Do not get me wrong, but I bet it's like one of them. If they've just got off the bus or they've just driven.
Oh
from
yeah,
them, as I said. Like,
but no, yeah, I don't. I don't begrudge them for having to speak to you.
No, maybe Steve stared at them the entire time.
Maybe that was it. Yeah. Sorry if I gave the impression that I thought they weren't nice. No, they were.
Not at all.
They were grand.
I've had chats with people in the past, and they're like, I met my heroes in a situation where it's probably not like the best situation at that very moment to meet them. And because you're a musician, you understand, like I said, hopping on the bus, just loading in, all this sort of stuff. I was lucky enough to meet Cedric from at the drive-in a few years back.
Cool.
And he didn't want to meet anyone. Like it wasn't like we didn't hunt him down or any sort of stuff. We just bumped into him in Birmingham in a vintage shop that I didn't know was there. And I could tell him, like, I'm not going to give up this opportunity. But you could tell he just didn't. He was somewhere else at that time, but but then I sat there afterwards and went, I shook his hand, said hello, that's it. I shouldn't have gone, can we have a photo and all this, you know, fangirl stuff that I probably shouldn't have done with, but it's great. Like, obviously it's nice when a band like that comes around for you, like I said, with Mission of Burma, where you don't just sit and listen to them at home. You don't just sit and enjoy them from the past. You actually then get the opportunity to play in front of them. That must have been, an amazing situation to be in.
Yeah, definitely. Like, it was, I mean, yeah, I couldn't have, like, you know, when I was sort of listening to them as a teenager, the idea of playing with these old punks, I never thought, it wouldn't have been a dream to sort of, to try and play with them, because I didn't think the opportunity.
Are there any like particular records or songs that sort of stand out for you? That I mean, I suppose people listen who might not know Mission to Burma that they should jump on straight away and sort of get them as hooked as you were, or would you sort of guide them to that Graham Coxon record and say, have listened to these two and then know what I was on about? Like,
no, I'd go for me, depending on which angle you're coming from. I mean, it's kind of about those first two records. I don't know how many records there are. Maybe there aren't that many more after that. I know they released
they
one in the sort
five
of noughties.
Records, I think.
Oh,
yeah.
Did they? Okay, yeah, obviously I'm a massive fan because I knew how many.
I'm not going to lie, I've got my notes from that. I'm running out of my notes on this.
But the second record, Signals, Calls and Marches, is the one that's got the hits on it, if you like, yeah. In inverted commas. Now, the first record, Verses, is a bit noisier, and on stage they were quite a noisy band, mm-hmm. And in some respects the real fans think that Signal, Calls and Marches is kind of a bit too toned down and not very representative of their live show. But to me, like, that's where the sort of the big songs, like Academy Fight Song, This Is Not a Photograph, and what's the big one? That's When I Reach For My Revolver. They're all like huge, like sort of pop songs, really, in the best way. And like, so if you're coming from like maybe if you're into your indie or more pop, then maybe that's better. But if you're a punk, maybe start with Verses, I would say. But
I remember I said I was chatting with James from Mutes about them, because I don't know if you have a chance to listen to him. He's literally the most passionate person in the world when it comes to music, and I admire him. Just for that, like I could have just said, pick some bands, James, and then I could have shut up for an hour and just let him get on with it, and it would have been the best listen. But we obviously went into sort of the talk about the Roger Miller's tinnitus, basically sort of ending the band for a period of time, and I guess that's almost like every musician's worst nightmare, having it. So not, you know, so bad that you cannot experience the music you create or listen to. You know, to the same level that you used to, and I can only like, I don't want to even imagine what that's like. I remember seeing Motorhead when I was 13 years old and being like coming out and just yelling for a week because I couldn't hear myself. But like, you know, I wasn't a touring working musician then. I couldn't imagine that affecting my life so bad. But it's a shame that it's great that they got back together for a couple of years towards the sort of mid to late 2000s, and then like I think it was 2016 they sort of did a few things as well. But I guess that was through, like, as we talked about, cult bands coming back, where they probably saw and went, a lot of people still really really love us, such as yourself, and it would be nice to do that again. I hope his hearing's not that he's probably ever going to listen to my little podcast here, but you know, I really hope his hearing is good, because again, I couldn't imagine that. I couldn't wish that upon anybody.
Yeah, I mean, that's like one of those sort of existential fears that, you know, will creeps into my head sometimes. But I don't know, I'm sort of pinning my hopes on there being some sort of technological solution by the time I'm sort of geriatric, where they'll be able to make sort of cyber eardrums, so it won't matter that
like
I can't really hear properly. that's my wish. I'm feeling it isn't good.
The next Nails album will just have to be like a nice little lullabies record, so you go on tour and it's nothing's above 60 dB, whispering.
Maybe. Yeah, maybe that's the solution.
So talking about loud bands, there's a band I'd like to bring up, which is Shield Your Eyes. I had a good listen to earlier on today, and it's progressive hardcore to the max, really. How did you come across those guys then?
So again, we toured with them, and played with them a lot, and they were kind of sort of contemporary. Well, I mean, I say we, my previous band Silent Front, did a split single with them and did a couple of tours with them. I mean, they probably hate, I'm pretty sure we would hate to be sort of labeled with any of the sort of punk or hardcore or anything like that. I mean, they're like, Steph, the guitarist, background is very much blues or classic blues guitar, although it's easy to sort of, in similar way to Ninkovsky, like they would get billed with bands, sort of mathy post-hardcore-y bands, but for them the root of what they did came from somewhere kind of different. And to me, like, I hear, I mean, Polvo are a band that I love, and I'm sure Steph probably has no interest in Polvo, but they're quite similar sounding. But Polvo are clearly a sort of, you know, a DC sort of noisy punk band, and Shield Your Eyes would call themselves like, well, progressive blues.
I think I read that when they did a great. I think it was supposed to be an article about their album, but instead of actually having an article about it, they just made a call and response conversation between themselves and just had some nonsense to talk about. And it was really funny. But then it says something like that. Yeah, they were like a post-hard blues band. And like the caption was, we're not sure if they wrote this or a fan wrote this, but whatever it is, it's probably completely wrong. And I'm like, well, they wrote themselves. There's no argument against that. But yeah, I kind of get that. I don't mean to pigeonhole them and I said they're sort of progressive hardcore sort of thing. But if someone was to go, I like progressive hardcore music, they could get into this sort of, into Shield Your Eyes quite sure, easily. Yeah. And then obviously that expands from there, the music that they released, where you then sort of, like I said, look below the surface and see a lot of the stuff that they put into it.
But I mean, like, whatever you want to call it, I mean, they were a phenomenal band. Like, luckily, Henry and Steph, so the guitarist and drummer, now playing a new band called Reciprocate. And so, because that relationship between sort of Henry and Steph was sort of the backbone of that band, for me anyway. And like, they're both, Steph in particular, has such an unusual sort of playing style and so prolific and worked so well with Henry that I'm glad that they are doing music again together. I think they do rip out a Shield Your Eyes cover every now and again.
For the hardcore fans. Not the hardcore fans. Again, yeah, I don't want them finding me and then saying, when please. I've just found that article and I've got to correct myself. It was actually, the headline is, the following transcript is a conversation I had with my psychiatrist, and it's the guy who wrote the article pretending to talk to a psychiatrist saying, I'm going to listen to more of Shield Your Eyes. And it's like, yeah, you've got to listen to it louder and you've got to hear the phrases. I can actually hear the pain. So I guess someone's heard it somewhere down the lines. But I mean, I'll try and share it with people like this, but it's a really, really funny and great read. But it kind of gives you a really good insight into it without actually saying much about the music. I suppose some journalists are going to try and do. I mean, that's 11 years ago that was that article was written. So I'm going right back to the past. And it was on Line of Best Fit as well. So, you know, that's as we know, quite a reputable journal thing for us. But
yeah,
we'll see if that got any more than 4 views, though, because it's quite a strange read. Yeah, when you said you toured with them, was it sort of mostly UK-based, I guess? Was that like early days with Silent Front, or did you do much with, I suppose, with Nails Technique? I suppose they weren't really...
It
was more Silent Front, yeah.
Yeah, it was with Silent Front. So there were two tours, one bit, so I was like the seventh drummer that Silent Front had. Like they went through a lot of them. And so the first tour they did with Shield Your Eyes was just before I joined. But then we did another... And that was a European tour. And then we did a UK tour after I joined. So, but I mean, in and around that, we played lots of other odd shows together and stuff. And did the split single as well. So, yeah.
Did you find that, you know, you talked about earlier about the listening to a band and they make you want to be either a better guitarist, a better drummer, or a better musician, or better this and the other? Were Shield Your Eyes one of those? But because you were so close to them as well, I find it really nice having an act that you can work with that they make you want to be better. So if you're on tour, I bet each night was just not trying to one-up each other, but pushing each other a little bit further. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, it's going on tour with Shield Your Eyes and Nick Koski for me was like a constant sort of feeling of inferiority. Like how the Silent Front were quite a sort of, not loose, but kind of, you know, we had a very solid sort of rhythm section, but it was quite a noisy sort of band. But Shield Your Eyes and Nick Koski so fully realized, and their talent is, and this playing so within their comfort zones, but are still doing absolutely amazing things. Like, yeah, sorry to bang on, but Steph's approach to playing guitar, never seen anyone play guitar like that before or since. I mean, like, watching live videos of them is incredible. Like, just the way that he's got this old hacked up sort of Strat, which he uses, or he used, that was his sort of main guitar, taking the springs out of the tremolo thing. So all the weird slidey, squealy things all come from him sort of manipulating the bridge with his wrist. And then he plays with like only three or four strings on it. I mean, it's totally batshit.
So everything you tell new musicians to not do with their instrument, basically, and he's basically nailed it. Like, yeah.
And it was like, apparently the guitar was like a USA Strat, like a really expensive guitar that he had since he was a teenager. But he hated it as much as he loved it. It was all hacked up and like absolutely shot to bits. But the sounds that he did and does get out of it are absolutely incredible.
Maybe it's that new thing where, I don't know if you're the same as me, if you get a new guitar pedal or you get a new guitar or you play someone else's guitar and it gives you a little bit more inspiration to make a different type of sound. I bet he might drop his guitar on the floor and break a machine head off and snap a string and they go, "Ooh, I like how that sounds now." And then like, that's his getting a new guitar pedal or that sort of thing.
Maybe, yeah. I mean, he seemed so inventive, like what he did. I mean, and he was like literally, you know, just a tuner and an amp. That's, you know, he's no effects. It was all in his technique, all in his sort of in his hands. It's like, yeah.
So it's the opposite nowadays, isn't it? Like, unless you've got a pedal board that doesn't fit in the back of a van, it's not really worth going on tour anymore. I remember seeing the guys in, do you know the band Iran Iran? They're like
I'm not sure I do.
Instrumental thing. Okay. And I saw them downstairs in, I don't know if you still remember, in Cardiff, in Undertone, which is underneath 10 feet tall. And that venue was tiny, but they're probably a bit after, was it? But yeah, the pedal boards, they just didn't fit on the stage effectively. And I remember looking at it going, these guys aren't musicians, they're river dancers, because there's absolutely no way that they can, you know, play all the pedals at the same time. It was almost they were doing more footwork than they were doing.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, there's an art to that as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Fair enough. Like,
I'm just jealous. But that's all I'm saying. I've only got four or five pedals on my board, and I've been collecting them for 20 odd years now. So,
I've got too many. I keep on. When we started USA Nails, it was like, this is going to be my no pedal band. I want a band no pedals. I want to be able to drink 5 pints before we play. I don't want anything to be complicated. And obviously, it never. You know. You go, I'll get a tuner. Oh, I need a noise suppressor. Oh, a bit of a line boost. Oh, I need my EQ. Oh, shit. And before you know it, you've got a fucking front door full of pedals on.
Yeah. And so you just have to hire someone to come and carry up the stairs into club upstairs for you next time.
yeah, maybe.
let's move on. I'm just going to pick one of these bands because there's a couple of bands that a couple of the acts I've spoken to that chosen that have been kind of hard for me to Google without worrying that the police are going to kick my door down or I'm going to get some questionable search engine results come up. But there's a band called Good Throb. And I properly enjoyed that. That is as punk as it gets, if you know what I mean, like as DIY and as raw sounding as it could possibly be. Everything sounds one take. But what's your sort of relationship with those guys?
So, I mean, they were around in London around the time that we were getting together, USA Nails, and they're a band that moved in circles like that we would have loved to have been accepted into, but we were never really good enough or cool enough to, like, Static Shock Records, and they put on a festival every year, and it's all like, it's proper punk, you know, and Good Throb were a band that had members of a few different bands that were kind of on the scene, but it was kind of a super group, and I think none of them really cared that much for it, but they inadvertently sort of made this amazingly accessible sort of really lo-fi but quite hooky sort of punk record, which they recorded under a railway arch in one day in Camberwell somewhere, but it's just, it's like a perfect record. And I think they did a bunch of touring off the back of it, and they got offered some good stuff, but, you know, proper DIY sort of feminist sort of punk band, like the right attitude, you know, the right, doing the right things. And I guess I think they've all gone on to do other pretty cool things, like musical and otherwise. I think Bryony is now you see her interviewed on the BBC quite a lot. She runs a campaign called Good Night Out, which is which is all about confronting sort of problems with
that's like the safe inclusion nights and you know
problems of abuse and in and around sort of music and entertainment and bars and clubs and stuff. They're all really right on people. I don't really know any of them personally, but I really admired them as a band, their sort of ethos, and they just had it all. But obviously, because they're really punk, they just didn't really care.
So I suppose that's what people admire about that sort of thing, isn't it? Yeah. Like, it's when you've got four or five, six, however many people all together who don't care but are still really good at it, you look at it and go, fair play. Well done. I mean, I get jealous when I see bands that they're just so effortless on stage and they come off and they're like, oh, yeah, that was all right. I'm like, you just blew my tiny little mind. What do you mean that was all right?
They're kind of almost like the opposites in it, Kowski, in the fact that, you know, it was all pretty lo-fi, the performance is quite sort of rickety, but it all just adds to the aesthetic of it.
Yeah,
and they have the charisma and the songs to just to pull it off.
You can sit and listen to the record you sent me and then know what it's going to sound like live, because like you said, that they haven't tried to do over the top recording and getting like someone to master it in the most perfect way and mix it in the most perfect way, because like you said, it's not that they don't care, it's like that is the ethos, that's the point behind it, that you can listen to that and then go, I want to go see this live, because it'll be like exactly the same but amplified. And in your face. And I love the whole like sort of ethos behind that. Obviously, you talk about the feminist punk rock and inclusion and stuff, and I think there's a huge place for that now. Not that there wasn't before, but I think it's really coming to the forefront now, and people sort of not taking any shit in the best possible way. And you know, like I said, making places safe for everybody and all inclusion. And it starts with that punk ethos, which, let's be honest, punk in the 70s was supposed to be, you know, we're all together in this. It's for everyone. Everyone's included, unless you're a conservative, I guess. But now a lot of acts, not just acts, sorry, like journalists and radio DJs and everyone are trying to push that ethos as well. And I'm really happy to see it come out. I'm really glad to have discovered this band as well, even though, again, never going to be able to see them.
Well, I mean, like you say, it's great. I mean, you know, it's still a long way to go, but it's good that this sort of agenda is being pushed more into the mainstream, and that's obviously only a good thing.
I do feel a bit shit being a straight white male saying this, you know, but I really do like, me and my colleagues, when we're doing shows and stuff, we do our very, very best to be as inclusive as possible with everyone there. And I really like to push as many people to the forefront, as I know you probably do as well, push to the forefront that are, you know, pushing the boundaries on things like that as well. So this is a shout out to everyone who's doing that wherever you are in the country and listening to this. So
Absolutely,
go and listen to Good Throb and then take their thoughts as well. Just Google it with the word band afterwards, because that was my my issue the first time. You know, you get your internet service provider going, are you sure you're searching for this?
Are we allowed to do swears?
Absolutely, as many as you like.
Oh, right, yeah. I mean, yeah, just the fact that the album's called Fuck Off is just encapsulate it.
Yeah.
Encapsulates it perfectly.
When you said that to me, I was like, is he just telling me to fuck off at the end of it? Is that like exactly what it is? But yeah, I mean, even searching Good Throb Fuck Off is kind of like on the
skip.
Don't Google it on the train. Just put it that way.
Don't Google it on your work computer.
That was the mistake I was making. Yeah, I might have to get a call from my GM tomorrow. Did you ever get to, I know you said that you, Nails might not have been able to get into that scene or anything, but did you ever get to like play any shows with them, or were there any sort of shows that you remember them putting on that you attended that you were like, this is it, like this is ethos, this is what I love?
We played with who was it? Now there's a band called Snob that came after Good Throb, and I believe the singer from Good Throb played guitar in. Am I remembering that correctly?
Is that Ellie Roberts? I've got my notes up in front of me here. It's got Snob. I think Ellie Roberts, singer. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I can't. Yeah. I, like I said, I didn't really know them personally, so I'm not sure
Someone out there will correct us, hopefully.
I'm sure.
Like we'll learn something new afterwards. So.
but yeah, so we booked Snob to play with us. We were booked to play with them in Oxford one night, and we asked them to do one of our album launches once. So we got to play with them then. And yeah, we'd had a couple of band nights out to power lunches and into some cool sort of London venues to see Good Throb and other sort of punk bands when they were. And it was always, always rammed and always a great sort of atmosphere and, you know, the right sort of vibe in, you know, lots of energy, but, you know, a very inclusive atmosphere.
So it's energy directed in the right place.
Yeah. So we enjoyed them more as punters rather than rather than being their peers, but that's totally fine.
Obviously. Oh yeah, absolutely. Like I said, I think it's great. Like there's a group here in Cardiff called the Ladies of Rage, and they've got that I think there's 30 or 40 of them in this sort of collective now, and they do either live music or DJ nights and things, and they're pushing the same sort of ethos as Good Throb, but down here in Cardiff, and you know, they're not to be fucked with in the best possible way. Like they're there, they've got a message, and you'll hear it, and it will be like one of inclusion and, you know, pushing boundaries. So it's nice to see, like, I suppose the connection between a band that sadly split up, you know, 5 or 6 years ago and stuff that's still going on now. I think the guys the people in Good Throb would absolutely love to be a part of Ladies of Rage, and I think they would like fit in absolutely perfectly as well. So again, it's a shout out to those guys there.
Nice.
Last band on the list, a band called Grass Window.
Widow.
Oh, Grass Widow. So sorry. My bad. That's probably why it's really hard for me to find them online. But yeah, they were the ones that sort of stood out a little bit more for me than some of the other bands, because they're not quite let's say as harsh, but they're a bit more on the indie rock side to it. How did you come across these guys? Because I think that, you know, the American band.
Yeah. So I think just I was at a gig and there was that a friend was putting on, and someone had put their record on in between bands, and my ears pricked up straight away, and I was like, wow, what's this? And yeah, found out about them, and then instantly went out and bought like a couple of their records, and was hoping that they would. I think by that time they had maybe toured the UK before, but I'd missed them, and they never toured the UK again after I'd found out about them. But randomly, once when I was on holiday, and I was lucky enough to find myself in San Francisco, one of the bass player from Grass Widow was playing a show with her new band at this bar somewhere. So I went along and sort of harassed her and asked for not harassed her. Sorry. That's the wrong word.
No, after the discussion we've just had, come on.
No. But I mean, I asked her, I emailed them before. Was like, oh, I'm really after this Grass Widow tape. And she was like, oh, sure, I'll bring one along. So I kind of got to meet her very briefly. And that was my only sort of live kind of window into sort of seeing that, you know, Grass Widow anyway. There's just something about it. It's quite sort of ethereal and like really atmospheric sort of sounding band with the three voices just sort of weaving in and out of each other. And then the music's quite complex and quite interesting. And again, it has like a lo-fi sort of loose feel to it, but the songcraft is so strong, and the ideas are so elegant and so well put together. Like it sounds like a really effortless sort of sounding band. It's just so liquid. It just flows. Like their songs just flow so beautifully, and there's I don't know, the fact that they come from the Bay Area makes me just think of, like, you know, just conjures up images of the Pacific Coast Highway. I'm sure they probably think that was cheesy as hell, but you know, but that sort of Californian kind of like 70s dream poppy aesthetic or something. Like
driving across the bridge in your soft top with the cassette in, listening to it. Like, yeah. I mean, they wouldn't be upset about that, because I guess it's like you said, if they're from there, that has to have been instilled in them, that style of, you know, looseness, freedom to write and play whatever they want to. If they didn't, if they were told that you didn't sound like that, I think they'd be disappointed. So.
Yeah, well, hey, maybe. I mean, but yeah, I mean, there are, I mean, but I think actually both Grasswood and Goodthrob, I don't think either of them announced that they'd split up, mm-hmm. but they just, neither of them have been active in many of them. They're as good as split up and they probably won't play. But who knows? I think I think that ship has sailed. I don't think either of those bands will play again. But
I mean, I reckon if you search somewhere down on the Primavera lineup with the tiny little font, they might still be playing somewhere. Because it seems like everyone on earth is playing festivals like that, or getting back together in a good way. Like
maybe,
Fingers crossed for next year. Obviously, when things get to normal, what's normal? Who knows what normal is anymore?
Well, quite. Yeah.
I want to say, obviously, thank you for bringing up all those acts and things. I'll once I've announced this, guys, I'll make sure I share all the Spotify links and mostly Bandcamp, I guess, for a lot of these acts that are on there too, because Spotify is evil, even though this podcast goes out on there. I'm basically helping Daniel Ek be able to afford Arsenal Football Club, and I don't feel good about it.
Saying that as an Arsenal fan? Or
As a football fan and a musician, Daniel Ek owning Arsenal just sounds like a terrible idea. But again, I might be alone in that. I might not be, so.
I mean, I quite like the idea of just saying you can stream our music on Arsenal now.
To be fair, yeah. Are you an Arsenal fan, are you?
No, I'm not.
Fair enough. I was going to say, because imagine the Arsenal team walking out to the new USA Nails record stream from Spotify in the Emirates Stadium.
Yeah, I can't say I could imagine them doing that. I mean, I don't really, I don't know what they walk out to.
I'll send Daniel Ek an email. I'm sure he'll pick it up, right?
I'm sure. Yeah, after that big compliment you gave him about being evil and that, I'm sure.
Yeah, but they are. They're a corporation. Right? That's how it works. But yeah, let's move on to some venues, because obviously this is something that's, I've thankfully been able to partner with the Music Venue Trust on this. And this is something I sort of wanted to bring up before I even had conversations with them, having my relationship with the Flapper, which sadly closed down last year. And so many venues, even pre-pandemic, that have had to shut down. But you've given me a list of four great venues. Let's start with one. Let's do one of the European ones, because I think I've only had one European venue in the whole of the podcast so far. So it'd be good to pick one of those two.
All right. Well, yeah, let's talk about Ground Zero in Lyon. Lyon is one of my favourite cities in Europe. I've got a lot of friends there now, and like, I don't know, the sort of scene there seems to be, well, I was going to say the scene is pretty cool, but what it is that the scene seems to be into the bands that I'm in, so therefore they are.
Nice. But, vicariously cool, I like it.
yeah, so I assume they're cool, or maybe that means they're really uncool, I don't know, but Ground Zero, right, in, like, technically, all right, there is a new venue called Ground Zero, which is kind of a more, I think, just kind of a straight up sort of, I don't know, like, I'm not sure what capacity is, 500 to 1,000 cap venue, maybe, but that, I've not actually been to the new one. So Ground Zero started as a squatted sort of a venue in an old bathroom warehouse stroke set of offices in the sort of centre of town. And they had two or three rooms that they put bands on in. So it was still very much like, it still very had all the trappings of bathroom warehouse sort of stuff, like, and which kind of added to the charm of it. But it was one of those, so I think, I'm not sure when exactly, they were threatening to close it down for ages. I mean, on the continent, it feels like community-run sort of squatted venues have a bit more of an understanding with local authorities in terms of what, you know, what they do for the community, and, you know, they run workshops and they do things for the local area, and they make sure they stay on side with the local residents and the local businesses, so they're not having a negative impact on the on their immediate surroundings. And so you used to, I think, get more venues like that in Europe that weren't really, you know, they were kind of illegal, if you like, but you know, they were a blind eye was turned to them because of what they did.
Because they had their place in the community, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And Ground Zero was a place that, for me, like really encapsulated what a community-run, sort of not-for-profit kind of venue with people running it because they believed in this idea of, you know, wanting to sort of create a place for bands to come and for people in Leon to come and see music. And it was kind of an all-in-one. So they had, so you had the venues downstairs and the bar, and then upstairs where the offices used to be, they turned that into sort of like living, like rooms for bands to stay in and stuff. Yep. And, but it was all, I think like there's an idea, especially in the UK, the idea of a squat is like somewhere dirty. Somewhere, yeah. Kind of.
Yeah, because a bad no name, power. I guess. Like.
Yeah. I mean, like, what's the, it's like almost onomatopoeic, isn't it?
Yeah.
Some people squat, but I think, but it was a beautiful like example of what a place like that could be and how well it was run. So professional, but at the same time, it was all people doing it. People were there for the right reasons, and and I only got to play there myself once. But anytime we were in Leon, we'd always be the people that ran it would say anytime touring bands would come through Leon, you could stay at the accommodation that they had there. That's the kind, and we would pay a contribution towards that, but it was like you know a nominal amount and. Yeah,
like what your travel lodge fees, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, this is like, you know, I mean, I've stayed in plenty of F1 hotels in France and they are dirt cheap, believe me. But this, and I like an F1 too, but these were like really, you know, obviously it cost next to nothing to be there and, you know, like good people around and stuff. And I really love that venue. And, you know, it had like proper cool, like noise rock bands from all over the world and not just noise rock, but all sorts of punk and indie and sort of bands, I suppose, predominantly there. And yeah, it was, yeah, an amazing place. And it's a shame that it's no more, but at least they do have, you know, a new, more venue-y venue in its place, I suppose. But yeah.
Just might not have the same sort of feel about it, I guess, if you went there.
No, I think it's out of town a bit more, and it's and I think it's in inverted commas legal. Therefore it can't be as good, basically.
that's a fair point.
Yeah.
There's a venue in Brussels you put on this list as well. Is it Barlock? Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Barlock, yeah. Okay. So in Brussels, like for a band like us touring like Europe, the venue that most people talk about in Brussels is one called Magasin Catch, Magasin 4. And Barlock is like right next door to Magasin Catch. And Magasin Catch is amazing. It's like, it's a bit like Ground Zero, but the venue is probably slightly bigger. It's got, you know, the purpose, but it's sort of community run, kind of dubious legal status.
A great area.
But great bands come through and it has a legend and it's an amazing place, like Magasin. But for me, I really, Barlock came along a lot later and it only existed for a few years. And it was like Magasin Catcher's, apologies for my French pronunciation, but it was like its dirty, grotty, little punky brother. It was a smaller room with a kind of a shitter PA, not really anywhere to stay that was decent. But we played a couple of shows there and they were wild. Like they were, it just seemed after going on about like how organized and how responsible people who run Ground Zero are. And then Barlock was kind of a little more unhinged than that, but that was kind of just added to its appeal. It was, it was a crazy place. And the shows were a bit more intimate there than its big brother venue, the Magasin. But I kind of missed that. And again, I guess because of its
questionable legality.
It kind of ended up going away. And I think that area of Brussels, which is right on the sort of dock side, is kind of being redeveloped. There's lots of flats put. So whereas it used to be industrial, now, of course, same story here in so many cities. Like,
yeah, everywhere in the UK at the moment.
Yeah. So sadly, that's no more. But But what I like about, I don't know, I have faith that, you know, there are people who sort of in the DIY community and put on shows are very tenacious, and they'll find places to put on shows, and they'll find, you know, they've always had to be very resourceful. So hopefully they'll continue to be, and yeah, and keep on finding new and interesting places to put on shows.
Do you prefer those type of places then? I know this is a stupid question because I already know the answer to it, but do you prefer those type of places then to like Euro 2 Academy or your typical touring venue in the UK, for example? Like, would you rather, you know, plan a show, go to, let's just say, Bruges, and then you've just found a venue, and then you turn up and it's like one of these sort of venues. Do you like discovering it like that rather than knowing that you're going to turn up and go, right, there's going to be someone there to help us load in. There's going to be a hot food rider. There's going to be a green room. We're not going to have to sleep on bunks all together. And so, do you like that discovery of a DIY venue in a community?
Yes. I mean, both have good sides to them. And like, I mean, both can be good and both can be, you can have shit shows and good shows at both.
That's a very good point.
And like, ultimately,
you're very diplomatic.
Well, you'll remember a venue as being good if you had a good show there, but it doesn't matter how good it is if you have a shit show there. And we've played great shows at shitty venues and vice versa. And yeah, both have their upsides, but yeah, a bit of a variety, I suppose. That's it.
Moving a bit closer to home, well, more likely your home, I guess, here. If it's all right, I'd like to bring up the DIY spaces for London. So what's the deal with that then?
So DIY space for London. So it only closed in the last year, I think. But it was, so for the longest time, for a good, I don't know how long, but when I moved back to London, there was this campaign to like try and find a DIY space for London, like because of the slightly more strict laws than they have on the continent. You know, the idea of doing a squatted venue in London is quite difficult, although there have been some.
It lasted about 4 hours.
Yeah, that's it. So they wanted to, you know, do a fully legal space that ran community events. They had like a screen printing room, rehearsal space, wanted it to be, you know, very accessible and open and inclusive. And so for years, it felt like, wow, they've been doing this fundraising and doing this search for so long. Will there ever be one? And then lo and behold, they did actually end up finding a place. And I was like, yeah, this is, and it was great. Like, it was in South Bermondsey, so not exactly a, you know, you're not going to get many on an industrial estate in South Bermondsey. So not the kind of place you're going to get lots of walk-ins in.
Yeah. But
that was not really a problem, you know. That wasn't. It was quite.
If you get one somewhere like that, they'll seek it out. Like,
you exactly, like, it's a destination, you know. And yeah, it was again run like with a sort of very much community vibe, all sort of not for profit, you know, a lot of volunteers. But ultimately, yeah, like it folded in the last year, I guess partly due to COVID, increased rates. I mean, within London, with, you know, obviously, whereas with any sort of big cities, it's, or even small cities, like keeping up with rates and rent and stuff like that is just gets more difficult. So I assume that's why they couldn't carry on with it. I don't think it was anything to do with, licensing or anything like that.
Yeah, just solely down, I say not solely down to the pandemic, but I guess the lack of support, I think. I mean, this is one of the sort of a good venue to bring up. The reason why I want to talk about them is because external people, let's just say just punters, I said people like yourself who are in the industry, who understand, you know, you said you talk about licensing, you talk about being able to get this, that and the other. People don't tend to see that. So when a band really does need its support, you go, oh, it's okay, someone else will help support it. And that's when, you know, the unfortunate things happen where places do have to close down, or like you said, places get redeveloped because the people making the decisions. Now I'm generalizing here, so obviously I don't mean to cause any offense to anyone, but people who are making the decisions seem to be the ones who don't understand what they places like that mean to the community. You said that they're not just, it's not just a a noise rock punk venue. That might look like from the outside for someone with a shirt and tie who goes to work 9 to 5 every day. It's, like you said, a print shop. It's a community space. It's a cafe. It's a, you know, somewhere to meet your friends. It's somewhere to help you with your mental health, you know, from just being social with people. And I feel like that gets lost, unfortunately.
Definitely. I mean, yeah, the and it's something that maybe in, again, sorry, not to keep on bashing on about it, but it does feel like the relationship that sort of some venues in on the continent have with local authorities and, you know, and various bodies have a slightly, there's a slightly better understanding of the what, you know, what they do for the community.
That's it. I feel like, again, I'm generalizing and so someone will correct me or whatever, but it does feel like you could go out tomorrow, Gareth, and set up a venue like this and know exactly how to run it because you know what it should mean to the community. But someone who just sits in a council office doesn't understand where you've come from, your upbringing with music and your upbringing with creative arts and things like that, what you know that it means to other people. Whereas over in Europe, I've not been lucky enough to go and play, but I've been to a lot of venues in Europe and seen bands like Idols and even bands like Queens of the Stone Age of that size, where you go to the venue and you go, this venue means more to the community than just being a music venue. It's everything else around that. It's a safe place for people to go. It's a place for people to work. It's a place for people to grow as musicians or artists. And I feel like the UK does that badly in comparison.
I mean, not incidentally,
but yeah.
I was going to say, incidentally, I do actually work for the council. I do sit in my council office and stuff.
But you have people who don't realise what you might do outside of work. And just look at a venue. I mean, obviously, we're going to talk about power lunches in a second, but look at a venue like that externally and go, I don't know what it brings to the community because it's not for those sort of people. Now, again, I'm generalizing and I realize I just threw you into the generalization there and I apologize wholeheartedly. But yeah, I mean, that's what I found. I mean, my relationship with the venue, the Flapper in Birmingham, I worked there for ages. I helped put on some of my best shows I've ever put on have been there. And it's getting shut down last year because one man with millions of pounds wants to build 64 inaccessible flats. And you go, well, there's 1,000 people a week who go to this venue and you're taking that away from them. And there's 1,000 bands that have played there and you're taking that away from the next 1,000 bands that are playing there. And it gets overlooked by it. Sometimes it is just one person.
I don't know. I mean, I can't get into the headspace of, you know, the decision making that goes behind, like why a venue like the Flapper will be closed, like what how much mind is given to, you know, the reasoning, weighing up, like, yes, of course we need more housing, and but I mean, how do you put a value on a venue and the arts and stuff like that? And I suppose if it's, yeah, when it comes down to just, I don't know what you can get better rates from, 64 flats or
that's it, isn't it? Like, it's dollar signs or pound signs in this instance in the eyes of the people. But again, I don't mean to generalize, but it is the discussion that I think more people should be having, where people like you and me and the people who listen to this podcast and musicians and artists will have those conversations with the people who are making the decisions to explain it more than just someone just looking at it from the outside. Because I think we'd be able to do ourselves a really good job, and I think we would help them do a much better job as well. Whether you agree with them on policies or politics or whatever, that's beside the point. I think if someone really can see what somewhere means to a community, they'll see it for the good that it does. Hopefully, again, I'm generalizing again, but yeah. Let's talk about power lunches. This was I think the one venue on the list that I knew about, again, for my age. And I'd heard a lot of stories about this. I had a couple of friends who used to put a couple of shows on there. Just around the time I was starting to do stuff at the Flapper. So it was one of them. You look at what Power Lunches were doing. It's about the same size venue, if not a little bit smaller. You look at the bands there and go, I want them in my venue downstairs as well. How does it go? But yeah, what was your relationship with Power Lunches then?
So we played, USNL's played a few shows there, and we went to see a bunch of shows there as punters. It's always a kind of place that was, that put on interesting stuff. It's in sort of Dalston area of London, so it's near where we rehearse and near where people you used to live, but they kind of don't anymore because it's really expensive around there now. But but yeah, there was always, even if you weren't really sure what was going on, they would generally have like pretty interesting things on like quite a few nights a week. And and the right sort of promoters that we were interested in, they put on good shows, put on nights at Power Lunches. So I don't really know much about how it was run in terms of like comparing it to the other venues I've talked about, but it certainly did feel like it had a bit more of a community vibe than some sort of, you know, than the Bull and Gate would in
Which is, it does say on the page that it's like a creative hub aimed at people rehearsing and meeting and you know, that social element to music before the live music actually starts, that sort of bit beforehand. But yeah, what were some of the, like, can you name a couple of shows that you went to that sort of stand out?
Well, I've never seen Good Throb there once or
they
twice.
They made the list of important bands that have played Power Lunches on.
Oh, yeah, they are very important. Saw a band called Ravioli Me Away there, who and I think some of them worked there, and so maybe they were kind of in a way a bit of a house band. But they're absolutely...
I love it when that happens as well, by the way, when you see a band and then after they finish set they go work behind the bar for 20 minutes. I absolutely love that because it shows you their connection with the place. I mean,
yeah,
basically, like, you don't necessarily work there for the money. I'm using inverted commas there. You do it because you love it. And if you can then go play a sweaty show and then just serve a couple of pints for an hour or so afterwards, I'd love it.
But yeah, they're a great band. I thought they'd split up, but I think they released an album not long ago, and actually they released it on Alter, maybe. But yeah, so they're sort of they're great. A weird, really synthy sort of lounge punk. I don't really know how you describe
lounge
it
punk,
but
wow.
But I don't know if that even exists.
It exists
maybe,
now.
Maybe, isn't it? Yeah, okay, fine. Just bass, synth and vocals and like a cocktail kit, so just like floor tom and a snare drum played by the singer. But their songs were quite subversive, but then, you know, lyrics about, they're very, very funny, very, but then quite right on as well, you know.
Like quite self-aware with it, I guess.
Very much so. Like they've got a couple of videos on YouTube which are brilliant, and some of the, I'll do them a disservice to try and describe them. I don't know. but anyway, yeah. So then they're brilliant. So probably went to see a bunch of. So I think the Static Shock Festival, they would sometimes have one of the venues as Power Lunches. So I probably saw a lot of bands. This was back in the days when I used to still drink quite a lot. So I've probably forgotten a lot of the bands that I saw.
That's fair. I had the conversation I had with Sam and Tom from Blackfish, which technically the episode came 2 weeks ago, whenever it is now, I lose track of what day of the week it was. And I said to Sam, oh, can you remember some like good tour stories that you might have had with Adabase of Shank? And he goes, be honest with you, I don't remember anything from all those times. I'm like, you had a good time. That's one thing that we can all agree on. But yeah.
Yeah. I don't regret them, but memory's just a bit hazy from that.
It'll come back. Don't worry. You know, like you said, with your mechanical hearing at some point, we'll be able to bring all our memories that we've forgotten from, let's say, enhanced nights out. That would be ideal.
Wow. Someone should send this as a treatment to Charlie Brooker.
This is actually a Black Mirror podcast. We'll see how...
Is it? Oh, no. We've got the copyright because we've talked about it first, though.
Yeah,
so,
I'll email it to you and email it to me, and then we'll sign it up from there.
And then sue the shit out of
them. I'm going to say thank you so much. This has been an absolute pleasure to meet you over Zoom and to have you on here. It's been an absolute, and again, I said earlier, but thank you for being supportive of the podcast. It really does mean a lot.
No worries. Thanks.
Yeah. Have a nice evening. I'm going to go and eat my tea now, like I always do, where it's much later than it should be. But I've had an absolute pleasure, Gareth, and good luck with you know, anything USA Nails related and stuff and basically everything. And I apologize about shitting on the council.
don't worry about it. Thank you. Thank you for having me.